Good morning. On today's programme, London grapples with a rise in knife crime and the problems of feeding fish with meal sourced from countries facing food insecurity. But first we go to the occupied West Bank in Palestine, where settlers who have illegally taken Palestinian land are expanding wine production and tourism. The settlers are routinely supported through donations and visitors from the United States. The establishment of vineyards has been used to seize large tracts of strategically located land in the West Bank, as Hannah McCarthy has been finding out.
The car speeds past fields of manicured grapevines that will soon be fermented and eventually bottled for sale at the Shiloh Winery that lies just off Route 60. The highway bisects the occupied West Bank, connecting Israel with a string of illegal settlements which are now home to hundreds of thousands of Israeli settlers. The Shiloh Winery is part of one such settlement, established in 1978 on land confiscated from the neighbouring Palestinian villages of Qarayut and Termasiah. It's here, on this rocky but fertile landscape, dotted with olive trees and limestone, that religious settlers believe 3,000 years ago stood the religious city, Tel Shiloh. Driving the car I'm in today is Dror Etkes, the director of Karim Navot, an Israeli NGO which tracks settlement activity in the occupied Palestinian territories. He says Shiloh is one of the most violent settlements in the West Bank. The Trump presidencies have emboldened many of these settlers who have rapidly expanded construction in the West Bank since 2016 and again since October 2023. What we see now in the West Bank is something which we never saw before, says Dror. During our visit to several vineyards and settlements, Dror points out disused entrance gates. These were abandoned after the borders of vineyards and settlements were expanded and new gates installed in territory that settlers had secured, either through force or by lobbying the local Israeli administration overseeing the West Bank. The settlements, which are illegal under international law, routinely receive donations and visits from America's Christian Zionist community, which view the return of Jewish people to the biblical land of Israel as a key step preceding the second coming of Jesus. Earlier this week, the US House Speaker Mike Johnson, a committed Christian evangelical, visited Shiloh along with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. During his visit, Johnson said that the mountains of Judea and Samaria belong to the Jewish people by right, using the biblical name for the West Bank that is favoured by both Israel's government and settlers. At one point, Dror and I stop at the Gavayot Winery backed by Daniela Weiss, a far-right Israeli settler known as the godmother of the settler movement and who earlier this year was sanctioned by the British government. Gavayot Winery is located on a strategic hill between the Palestinian cities of Ramallah and Nablus. If you control this part, you basically control the northern part of the West Bank, says Dror. He takes out a pair of binoculars and surveys the surrounding hill, looking out for any signs of a new path being built. I always look out for new roads being built, he says. It's a sign of a plan for a new settler outpost. Often a single settler with a caravan will move in overnight and begin the process of rendering the land off limits for local Palestinians. But where do these caravans come from? Well, at least some of them come from the Shiloh settlement. After driving through the main town area in Shiloh and past a few fields growing grapes and olive trees, Dror stops the car by an open field where dozens of caravans are being built, ready to start the next wave of settler outposts. As we drive even deeper along the dirt tracks and closer to the border with Jordan, we come to Esh Kodesh, a remote settler village constructed deep in the territory that Palestinians want for their state. Esh Kodesh started as just a few cabins and tents in 2000 and is considered illegal under both international law and Israeli law. Today, situated on a hilltop looking onto vineyards and the Palestinian villages of Kusra and Jalud, is the settler winery and cabin run by Aaron Katzoff and his daughter Naomi. Aaron is originally from California, and the bar area of the settler winery is decorated like a Midwestern American bar, with the staff wearing cowboy hats and live music playing on Thursday nights. Two freshly built cabins with jacuzzis on their balconies are available to rent for anyone travelling from far away who wants to stay the night at this remote settlement. The Israeli NGO, Who Profits, says that wine-based tourism provides an additional source of income for settlers and functions as a tool for normalising the seizure and exploitation of Palestinian land. As he serves a sparkling pink champagne called Biot from his bar, which has a sign saying Liquid Prophecy hanging behind it. I ask Aaron if he's ever trained as a winemaker. He replies that he's really more of a people person than a wine person. For RTÉ World Report, I'm Hannah McCarthy in Esh Kodesh.
To the UK next, assaults and robberies involving a knife have surged 60% in London over the last 3 years, and one in 15 attacks takes place in just a few streets there. The city is also struggling to cope with a wave of mobile phone thefts as criminals snatch the devices from people using them on the streets. Following public concern about increasing knife crime, the police are being urged to adopt new tactics to deter criminals, especially in high-risk areas, as Russell Padmore reports now from London.
I have to admit, Londoners are becoming very wary about the possibility of becoming the victim of crime, especially following a series of high-profile murders by a man carrying a knife. The government has put a positive spin on recent figures showing that robberies with a knife have dropped 6% across the country. But that will be little reassurance to people living and working in London. A third of knife crimes recorded in England and Wales are committed in the capital. The Metropolitan Police are under pressure to crack down in a small area of the West End. 20 roads around Oxford Street and Regent Street are the knife crime hotspot, and most of the offences are by criminals stealing mobile phones. It's worrying news for businesses trying to keep their staff safe, as well as the tourism industry. The shops in Oxford Street are popular with visitors. Many mobile phone thefts are committed by young people, illegally riding electric scooters and snatching a device from the victim as they pass by. Smartphones could be worth about €1,000. Experts are advising the police to adopt a zero-tolerance approach and carry out high volumes of stop-and-searches. But in the past, this strategy has seen officers accused of racism for stopping young black men. Last year, almost 84,000 phone thefts were reported in the UK, often linked to knife crime. The government set up a police task force to tackle the problem, and seven forces, including London and Manchester, were the focus of the operation. The Home Secretary, the government's Justice Minister, Yvette Cooper, said the annual reduction of 6% in robberies involving a knife was a direct result of targeted police action. But that's a small reduction from the high number of crimes. Londoners are well aware that the city's law enforcement body is being restructured amid plans to cut 1,700 officers and staff. It's feared fewer police make it easier for the criminals. It's worth noting that in Ireland, seizures of knives by the Gardaí have risen about 60% in the last decade, as the government is also trying to crack down on crime. Half of the seizures of knives were in Dublin. The Irish government also plans to increase the Gardaí's powers to stop and search anyone suspected of carrying a knife. The British public would like to see a visible presence of more police on the street, especially in the small area which is a hotspot of mobile phone theft here in London. The police are using drones, live facial recognition technology, and putting more plainclothes officers on patrol. Victims of mobile phone theft have accused the police of not investigating the crime properly. Cases of people using technology to pinpoint the location of their stolen device and alerting the police but not getting a response are becoming common. Officers are getting new powers to raid premises without a search warrant. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, said, "It is extremely frustrating for victims when they can see exactly where their stolen phone has gone, but nothing is done." There is also a public perception that the courts are being too lenient on criminals found guilty of stealing a mobile phone or carrying a knife. Hardliners call for jail sentences, but when prisons are full and inmates are being released early to make room, that's not an easy choice. Callers to radio phone-in shows here have been telling people not to use their phone in the street. Not so easy, though, for tourists following a map on their smartphone. A safer option appears to be going into a shop to make a call, so you're not vulnerable to a teenager riding an electric scooter snatching your mobile. Law-abiding people should be able to walk the streets and feel safe, but right now that's not the reality. British society is recognising the need to prevent young men getting involved in crime, especially those who feel marginalised or tempted to join gangs. It seems the safe but frustrating choice for carrying a mobile phone in London is to keep it hidden. A famous line from Hill Street Blues, an American police series of the 1980s, comes to mind. At the start of each episode, the officer in charge used to tell his colleagues, "Let's be careful out there." This is Russell Padmore for World Report in London.
Finally, we go to Portugal. As wild fish stocks decline and global demand for seafood rises, governments and corporations have turned to fish farming as a solution. But behind the promise of sustainable seafood lies a growing dependence on fish meal, often sourced from regions facing food insecurity. The global expansion of aquaculture comes at a cost to poorer nations, as Mark Godfrey reports now from Portugal.
Over the past two decades, I've watched a revolution in world food supply with the rise of aquaculture. As the planet's population has doubled in recent decades, the fish in our sea have dwindled. Aquaculture, or fish farming, has been presented as a solution to fewer fish and an economic opportunity. Countries across the globe have ambitious plans to farm fish for healthy food and as a new source of income for rural populations. Aquaculture has been presented as a solution to overfishing and to world hunger. Every country seems to have an aquaculture plan, usually referred to as a blue revolution or a blue miracle. But there's a darker backstory to the blue miracle. Most countries' aquaculture plans are for the farming of a handful of commercially valuable species, like shrimp and salmon. Ecuador, in little over a decade, became one of the world's biggest shrimp exporters. Saudi Arabia has big plans for shrimp farms. But by the time they reach anyone's dining table, the average shrimp will have eaten several times its body weight in other fish. Yes, carnivorous shrimp, like salmon, require a diet rich in fish meal, which is ground from fish like anchovies and sardines. Much of the global fish meal supply is sourced from anchovies fished in large volumes from the waters off Peru. But as the farming of shrimp and salmon expands globally, there's also an increasing number of fish meal plants popping up along the west coast of Africa. They grind up fish otherwise needed for food in a region with the world's fastest growing population. And that's the challenge of aquaculture. An industry of large, wealthy aquaculture corporations in Western and Asian countries feed fish which would otherwise be eaten by humans in a part of the world with growing food needs. There's an alternative vision of aquaculture in China. It accounts for 60% of the farmed fish in the world, but most of them are species which require little in the way of fish meal. Fish like carp and catfish and tilapia thrive on a largely vegetarian diet. That's why these fish are so affordable and sustainable in developing countries, but it's also why they're of little interest to the investors in a new wave of offshore fish farms springing up in China. These farm far more expensive species. As Chinese consumers become wealthier, they too want to eat salmon. Expansion is happening elsewhere too. Turkey has built a huge business supplying fish meal hungry sea bass to European restaurants and retailers. Norway's wealthy salmon companies are seeking to expand their salmon farms in Ireland. Across Latin America, countries want to replicate Ecuador's success and sell shrimp to the West and to Asia's growing middle classes. How to feed all these fish, though, will dictate whether aquaculture is a solution to world hunger, as many of its promoters claim, or a driver of hunger. The companies who trade the bulk of the world's fish meal are Western, Chinese and Japanese. The Western ones have come up with a certification program so that fish farmers can see if the fish meal they're feeding their shrimp or salmon comes from a sustainable source. It's like fair trade for the fish meal industry. It's a start, but few of the buyers in China, the world's biggest fish farmer, have signed up to these certifications. In Africa, the certifiers have struggled to collect data, so it's not clear if the fish in the fish meal is food from African tables. The other solution is alternative feed sources. Researchers and feed companies around the world are testing a new wave of feed products. some of them ground insects, some from the waste of meat and fish processing factories. Aquaculture may be a food revolution, but its ability to feed the world may depend on a new way to feed the fish. For World Report, this is Mark Godfrey in Portugal.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by John Burke. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.